Thessaloniki through the eyes of 12th century Byzantine writers. Throughout the Byzantine period, Thessaloniki played an indisputably important role in the life of the empire. Its strategic position at the crossroads of the major trade routes in the Balkan Peninsula and its harbour, which was a key source of wealth down the centuries, rendered it the second largest city in the empire after the capital, Constantinople. From the 3rd century on, when it became the seat of Galerius, one of the co-emperors of the Tetrarchy, Thessaloniki was adorned with an imperial palace and several opulent, imposing public and private buildings, thus ushering in a lengthy period of prosperity that directly influenced the city's form and development. The city retained the ground lines of the Roman town plan for centuries. The main thoroughfare was the Via Regia, known in Byzantine times as Mesiodos or Leophoros, with a number of vertical and horizontal roads running along existing courses. From the 4th to the 6th century, large opulent houses were built on the blocks on either side, generally decorated with stunning mosaics and boasting banqueting rooms, reception areas, living quarters, cloisters and gardens, all reflecting the wealth of the prosperous urban class that was present in the city up until the 6th century, if not later. As is evident from the archaeological record and more indirectly from written sources, after the 7th century, the large urban villas of the first Christian centuries were replaced by small one- or two-room buildings that housed the inhabitants of the Byzantine city. Along with urban development, Thessaloniki soon grew into one of the major ecclesiastical centres in the Balkan Peninsula. Quite early on, large parish churches were built both within and outside the city walls, later augmented by numerous monasteries with large communities of monks and nuns. Archaeological evidence has so far shown that over 20 churches were built in the city during the early Christian centuries. Most of them were destroyed in the early 7th century, while only a few were to survive the centuries to come. Yet over the course of its history, the main pilgrimage shrine remained the church of Agios Dimitrios, dedicated to the patron saint who saved Thessaloniki from the Slavic invasions in the 7th century and protected it against subsequent threats. Originally built in the 5th century on the hills in the northwest, the Church of Agios Dimitrios was the principal pilgrim's church in the city and one of the largest in the Byzantine world, a place where the faithful flocked to secure the martyr's blessing and unction from his grave. A vivid narrative by Timerion, a pilgrim who came from Constantinople to Thessaloniki to worship Saint Dimitrios, tells us that in the 12th century a large trade fair was held outside the western city walls during celebrations for the patron saint's feast day. There, Greek merchants pitched rows of tents and sold fabrics shipped to the city from Boeotia, the Peloponnese and Italy, furniture from Phoenicia, Egypt, Spain and the Pillars of Hercules, and animals, mainly horses and donkeys from the Black Sea area. At the same time as the fair, all-night vigils led by a prelate would be held in the church of Agios Dimitrios, where hymns were sang for the martyr by the light of lamps and candles. On the morning of October 26th, flanked by a guard of men on horseback and on foot, the Duke of Thessaloniki would enter the church to the cheers of the crowd, honor the saint and then take his seat next to the city's archbishop for divine liturgy to begin. Scholars place Timerion's visit to Thessaloniki in the first half of the 12th century at a time when the city enjoyed great prosperity. However, Byzantium's political fortunes changed significantly in the second half of the century, especially after the ascension to the throne of Andronicus Comnenus from 1183 to 1185, whose massacre of the Latin community in Constantinople provoked the ire of the West. The Normans of Sicily attacked Byzantium almost immediately thereafter, and in 1185, Norman forces under Baldwin led siege to Thessaloniki. Eustathius, archbishop of the city, witnessed the events that followed and described them in all their violence. Let's listen to him. It all started one morning in August 1185. This day was like no other. It felt more like a night full of pain and sorrow for all it bore witness to. Thick fog fell like the dust thrown up by a hurricane or the hooves of countless animals. It was as if the sun was ashamed to rise, since the brilliance of weaponry shone brighter than it. You could also see that the sky emptied of birds, and I do not know if this was because the air was heavy or because the whole situation was atrocious for them. Many days passed without a bird flying in the sky, neither a sparrow, nor a dove, nor a raven, birds that were previously very common in our parts, nor any other. All had gone elsewhere and vanished from sight. Once the enemies fell upon it, the city suffered all the wrongs a fierce war imposes. So, having lost of all hope of refuge in the citadel due to water shortage, and having dispensed the provisions I had gathered for myself and those close to me, I also abandoned the idea of seeking refuge in the holy grave of St. Demetrius or in other sacred churches. I was not unaware that as everyone wanting to escape flocks there, many are crushed to death or suffocated by the lack of air brought about in such cases. So I stayed in my house, which is rumored to have hosted the saint when he was still alive. Having witnessed and suffered myriad evils, which only a miracle can have enabled me to endure, I was finally dragged by my beard and led to captivity through thousands of drawn swords, waving like a field of corn. Elias, how many tragedies ensued! As if the corpses I encountered while still walking were not enough, still steaming with hot blood, I came across even more when on horseback. Most lay peeled in front of the walls in such numbers that my poor pony could not step on the earth or had two or three corpses between its front and hind legs. The barbarians filled the city, streaming in first from the eastern gates. They mowed our people down and tied them in bundles, peeled them in stacks like the ones favored as fodder for hades. Those who tried to escape by running through the streets lost their lives. Then their bodies were despoiled and left naked. Thus the streets were transformed into wretched cemeteries, and the sun could see what should not be seen. Attacks in the streets and destruction wrought on houses would not be considered unusual acts in the course of a war, but the desecration of the churches could not but be described as tantamount to a war waged against God. Indeed, the barbarians raided every church, committing profanities such as could have led God to react. They donned the most sacred vestments as if they were breastplates, and wounded many priests, in most cases fatally, some within the very altar area, others outside it, wherever the slayers found them praying to God. Most desecrated the holy vessels and destroyed the venerable icons, or at least those not inlaid with precious metals, stripping the remainder of their decoration by hitting them. Some barbarians, who deserved to be punished by the same weapon, rushed upon the grave of St. Demetrius with axes, cut off the silver decoration surrounding the grave, stole the gold crown covering the saint's skull, and removed the bones of one foot so as to avoid swift punishment by him. What could I say of those who, when surrounded by evil, climbed on rooftops to seek death? Unable to fly up into the air as they wanted, they fell victim to the law of gravity and plunged down from on high to their death. And what can I say of the men and women who threw themselves down wells, as if they were the waters of the Cocytus and the Acheron? I weep now to recall how we all ran, like sheep to the slaughter, to save our lives, without a shepherd or a laborer to defend us. The corpses were in their thousands, so many that a city once full of honest people was emptied. All the knights outside the city walls, the ship's commanders and their followers, now free of ordeals and not wishing to sleep out in the countryside any longer, boldly began to occupy houses in the city. The largest were reserved for the chiefs and their retinues. The smaller were given over to groups of men, depending on the capacity of the lodgings. From then on, the enemies were in the houses, while all the citizens among them roamed the streets. The barbarians took over the supplies stored in the houses, while their owners were persecuted and left to wander here and there, hungry and thirsty, shivering from the cold, as they were also naked. Only the prostitutes were dressed in finery, for they wore ecclesiastical veils. Thus adorned, they accompanied their unholy lovers and freely indulged them in sin in front of our eyes, ignoring everything when they were with them. How great was the forbearance of God in this case, too! If any of the home owners roaming here and there recalled his home, thought of his property, and wished to go and have a look, they would ask him who he was and why he was behaving thus. When he replied that he had once been master of the house, they would greet him pleasantly and with honors and bring him into the house courteously, kissing him and giving him the place of honor, and then ply him with food and wine. Yet this reception by the barbarians was to prove fatal, as it was followed by him being strung up, beaten, and subjected to straw smoke and other tortures without precedent, so to make him reveal hidden money and hand it over to them. Once he had given them what they wanted, a new round of torture began. The poor man was hung up and badly beaten anew, until the executioners either gained more or were overcome by pity. At this point in the narration, I should begin mourning and bewailing our misfortunes. But that is not easy for an old man. Also, such words do not become a bishop of God, who ought only to thank and praise him, and it is because of him and for him that we exist. Nothing, however, can prevent me from saying just one more thing before I end. That if someone were to say they had never seen greater calamities anywhere in the world, they would not be claiming the absurd. The Normans occupied the city from August to November 1185, committing all manner of atrocities and laying waste to churches, houses, and people. With the rise to the throne of Isaac II Angelus, peace was restored, and the city continued to live and grow in the Byzantine Empire, following the fortunes of the capital. Both written sources and archaeological data reveal the dynamic presence of Thessaloniki in the late Byzantine period, when there were many scholars, theologians, monks, and artists living and working in the city. Together, they contributed to a major flowering of culture that lasted until 1430, when Thessaloniki fell for the last time, on that occasion, to the Ottomans. The events that unfolded were recorded with the same intensity as ever by a cleric named Ioannis Anagnostis, who was taken prisoner by the new conquerors. The protagonists had changed, and the dates were different. Here began a new chapter in the history of Thessaloniki, reflecting the new order as regards history, politics, culture, and urban planning.